want to tie up the Christians, as they indicate. With his own eyes, the heathen prophetic eyes saw, and he spoke of it reverentially, hidden secrets in the constellations. The story of the Grail is derived from Flegetarus having seen hidden secrets in the constellations. He declared there was a thing called the Grail, whose name he read in the stars, without more ado. A troop of angels left it on earth and then rose high above the stars. A Christian progeny bred to a pure life had the duty of keeping it. Thus did Flegetarus write on this theme. The wise master Pilate embarked on a search for this tale in Latin books, and we are where we meet that earlier quotation. The wise master Kant embarked on a search for this tale in Latin books. He read the chronicles of various lands in Britain and elsewhere, in France and in Ireland. But it was in Anjou that he found the tale of this Christian great community. He read the truth. He read the truth about Mazadan. What's an interesting word suddenly to pop up. He read the truth about Mazadan. Think about that one. Beyond a doubt, the account of the latter's whole lineage was faithfully recorded there. And on the distaff side, that is on the female side, how Titurel and his son Frimutel bequeathed the Grail to Amfortas, whose sister was Hetsiloide, on whom Gamaret got a son, to whom this tale belongs, i.e. Parsifal. So this is Parsifal's lineage. He has a mother, Hetsiloide, who married Gamaret of Anjou, and he was the son of Frimutel, who was in line the son of Titurel. So it's a kind of Grail lineage here. These are quite interesting figures that we'll return to them. There's much to disentangle here, but basically we're to understand that the story of the Grail is to be found in an astrological tradition going back at least as far as Solomon, about whom one of them says elsewhere that, quote, he had more perfect knowledge of the course of the stars than any saving God himself. So, Flegetarus, that the Jewish astrologer Flegetarus took the story from the astrological constellations suggests that we are dealing specifically with a tradition concerning the Zodiac. And this is further suggested by the reference to Mazadan, that he knew the truth about Mazadan, whose historical importance we will explore in a moment, but who here in the fictional narrative is represented simply as a remote ancestor of the house of Anjou, and therefore of Parsifal, who was the son of Hetsiloide. Hetsiloide's brother is Amfortas, the Fisher King, and the Fisher King is part of the line of Grail kings who will be succeeded by Parsifal, those preceding Amfortas being Frimutel and then Titurel, the first known Grail king, about whom Wolfram von Eschenbach wrote a separate romance after 1217, which survives only in fragments. This line of Grail kings is related to, in some way then, to the truth about Mazadan. What is this truth that is being so obliquely approached? Presented as a remote ancestor of the Master Anjou, the figure of Mazadan hints at the Master Anjou's tradition, known to the Christian House of Anjou, but which goes back from Jewish traditions to earlier Zoroastrian tradition. For Zoroaster had famously taught that life on earth consisted of a struggle between Ahura Mazda and Ahriman, i.e. between the forces of light and darkness. In other words, Wolfram's Mazadan is Zoroaster's Ahura Mazda. But what has Zoroaster's Mazda to do with astrological traditions? Well, Zoroaster had taught that the struggle between Mazda and Ahriman was taking place over one cycle of the zodiac, a different epoch or age for each sign, thus suggesting that the constellations which zodiacal constellations governing the great epochs of time. Just how much Wolfram knew of Zoroastrian zodiacal theology is a moot point, but he certainly knew a lot about Arabic astrology, which in turn had assimilated Zoroastrian astrology. And the one that he was positive, he refers to Zoroaster as king of Arabia. So the idea that he was aware of a line of descent from Zoroastrian astrology to Arabic astrology concerning the zodiac is the basic idea that I want to put to you. I'm not at all far-fetched. But Wolfram's insistence that his story also has a Judeo-Christian descent, from Solomon to Flegetanus to the baptized Christian Kayot, is important too, suggesting ultimately that the specific astrological tradition he's talking about was widely disseminated in the ancient world, emerging in Zoroastrianism, but transmitted to successor civilizations of all kinds. And certainly this is historically plausible. A Jewish debt to Persian Zoroastrianism is not disputed by scholars. A Jewish debt to Persian Zoroastrianism is not disputed by scholars. At this point, we should remind ourselves that the general drift of Parzival is the story of a young knight who advances by degrees to finally become the next Grail king and ushers in a time of joy, which follows on from a time of sorrow presided over by the wounded Fisher King, whom Parzival first meets in the castle where he sees the Grail pass in front of him. It's carried in by a maiden wearing a cloak of Araby. And at its first mention is described as a thing called the Grail, paradise, transcending all earthly perfection. All kinds of food are served from it, quote, for the Grail was the very fruit of bliss, a cornucopia of the sweets of this world, and such that it scarcely fell short of what they tell us of the heavenly kingdom. As we've heard, a troop of angels landed on earth, and we are later told that these were neutral angels, quote, worthy, noble angels, who did not take sides when God and Lucifer battled in the heavens. The Grail is a stone, whose name is Lapsit Exit, a pseudo-Latin mix which suggests the phrase, the stone of exile. Nevertheless, it is by this stone, he says, that the phoenix is burned to ashes, in which he is reborn a dazzling, bright, and lovely thing. It's also the stone upon which a dove leaves a holy wafer every Good Friday, quote, from which the stone receives all that is good on earth, the food and drink of paradisal excellence. From this we may gather that the Grail is involved in the regeneration of fallen man, and his readmittance to paradise, a historical process central to mainstream Orthodox Christianity, but here presented as something quite different, a greater Christianity involving many non-Orthodox elements, such as Arabic astrology and the thoroughly non-biblical truth of neutron angels. The poem presents Christian Parzival, Arabic Fearfiz, as almost equal heroes in their half-brothers, Gaumet's father's Fearfiz, upon a dusky maiden of Arabic fathers, our hero, Sir Parzival, a European queen, so he has this Arabic part of it. The tale switches between the two. Then towards the end of the tale, they come together. So the poem presents Christian Parzival and Arabic Fearfiz as friends, as almost equal heroes in the tale. Both are sons of Gaumet and one Jew, and both of them make the final approach to the Grail Castle together, with the blessing of the seven planets, which Wolfram names in the Arabic. That's strange, isn't it? This is a very Sicilian. Harry, Christian, George, Muslim mix. Well, how do we explain the presence of this mix of Jewish, Arabic, and Christian theosophy centered upon ancient astrology? Very little is known about the life of Wolfgang von Eschenbach, except that his patron was Landgrave Hermann I of Thuringia. His court was a thriving centre of literary activity in the early 13th century, when Wolfgang was writing. However, this information is enough to connect the heterodox grail material of Wolfgang's Parsifal with a similar soup of religious beliefs found in Southern Italy in the Crusader court of Otranto, depicted in a floor mosaic which mixes Arthurian, biblical, and astrological materials, which we'll look at in some detail in a moment. It's possible to connect these two works of art, Wolfram's Romance and Otranto's Mosaic, both produced at about the same time, because Wolfram's patron, Hermann, was much involved in the affairs of Sicily and southern Italy, first by aiding the Holy Roman Emperor Henry VI in his project of adding the Kingdom of Sicily to the Empire, by virtue of Henry's marriage to Constance of Sicily, and later Hermann Theodore gets involved too by inviting their son, Frederick, who we'll hear more about from Christopher, to become King of Sicily, and afterwards Emperor Frederick II. So Wolfram's patron is something of a kingmaker, an emperor, acting behind the scenes here in Sicily and in southern Italy. Sicily at the time when Hermann would have known it, and when Wolfram may have accompanied it here, was, as we know, a fascinating mix of Arabic, Greek, Christian, and Jewish peoples, and also a major gateway for the transmission of Arabic astrology into medieval Latin Europe. There was mention of that this morning, of the medical work coming in by Constantine the African, translated all of that Arabic stuff into medieval Latin, and that represents the first intrusion of Arabic astrology into European life. Much, much more came later by Toledo. It was here in Sicily that the first of that Arab astrology began to enter the bloodstream of the European Middle Ages. So astrology is very much on the agenda for this area. So Sicily then was a major gateway for the transmission of Arabic astrology into medieval Latin, a cultural situation which helped to account for the prominence of Judeo-Arabic astrology in the Romance poem and its presentation of Christian Parsifal and Arabic theophys as almost equal theories. This mixture of Christian faith and Arabic astrology, so prominent in Wolfram's Arthurian poem, bears eloquent testimony to his patron's in Sicily, who gave birth to astronomy. But Sicily was first and foremost a Norman possession at this time, a place where the Normans had introduced stories of Arthur and the Grail for reasons to do with the unorthodox Christian teachings they held dear, passed down to them via the House of All Jew, or some such sort. So how did they protect this non-orthodox form of Christianity, let's call it Grail Christianity, how did they protect this from ethnic interference? As the historian Eve Morsel puts it, quote, in the Pope's eyes, Sicily was a fief of St. Peter's, but this was not so in the view of its Norman and Roman conquerors. Nevertheless, the Pope charged Roger I with the reform of the Sicilian Church, i.e. by replacing Byzantine with Latin clergy. In the interests of religious conformity, the Count Rodolatis was allowed to have the final say in establishing dioceses, choosing bishops, and approving papal legates. This was a new development in the Catholic world, papal legates of America. conformity of faith throughout his ministry. And the Pope was keen to send his papal legates down here to Sicily and southern Italy, Rome and Normans, who were more interested in preserving real Christianity rather than papal Christianity. So, how did they get around this particular problem? Well, the deal was that if there was any discord on the point of approving papal legates, part of the bull of 1098 conceded that if no papal legate was available on the island, the northern ruler could act as a substitute called a legati vice legate. And in fact, the De Hortevilles, the ruling Norman family, forbade any other papal legates on the island. They themselves always insisted upon their right to be vice legates. So no papal legates were allowed in. This was a Pope-free zone. and the ruling aristocracy insisted that the high clergy could only approach Rome through the Norman ruler. So, sealed off. In other words, Norman Sicily and southern Italy, which formed part of the Kingdom of Sicily under the De Hortevilles family, enjoyed a freedom of religious reference unthinkable in Christian Orthodox quarters. A freedom to reflect local astrological traditions, no doubt, but mainly, as I hope to show, a freedom to promote the specific brand of astrological Christianity which the Normans had brought with them, which sustained them in what they believed to be their divine historic mission. Well, what that mission was and how they traded in their churches, we must now consider. Turning to the rich mosaic programs of Sicily and southern Italy, which the Normans created in the 12th century, I've just got a few copies of this. We're not going to look at any details. Don't take one, just take one. Just to make sure that everyone can see it.
Descended from Vikings that moved into northern France in probably the 9th century there.
And you have photocopies of both. One from the Capella Palatina in Palermo, and
they were all in the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. They even went into the Vikings were in the Black Sea even earlier.
The Norman conquest, so what's this got to do with their self-perceived divine authority? The Norman conquest of Sicily in 1091 was very much related to the conquest of Jerusalem a few years later in 1099, which Norman forces and soon the two new Christian territories, Sicily and Jerusalem, were yoked together by the marriage in 1113. Between Adelaide, widow of Sicily's first Norman ruler, Catherine I, and Adelaide's widow is now married to Baldwin the first king of Jerusalem. And that marriage comes with an agreement that should have been barren, which it did. The kingdom of Jerusalem would pass to Adelaide's son, the future Roger II of Sicily. In fact, this agreement was not honoured, but it gave Sicily an abiding claim on Jerusalem, which was eventually fulfilled in 1229 under the future Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II, King of Sicily and King of Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the Sicilian Normans clung to what they believed was their divine mission to incorporate Jerusalem, a mission which, according to E. Borsa, the Wax Mountain Mosaics, they alluded to in the magnificent program of 12th century royal mosaics created in the Cappella Palatina and the Marmignano in Palermo. Describing the cycle of mosaics in the nave and aisles of the Cappella, Borsa remarks upon, quote, the theme of sacred mission and return to Jerusalem or paradise, which is taken up, she says, in several mosaic sequences, and discussing one of them in detail, she concludes, quote, taken as a whole, this mosaic sequence of creation to Jacob is essentially concerned with mankind's return to paradise, whether in the guise of the geographical Holy Land or the visionary promised land of Israel. In the illustration of the Cappella Palatina I have provided, you can see a picture of Christ Pantocrator facing you in the apse, framed by an arching inscription in Latin, which begins, in translation, the lance, the sponge, the wooden cross, the nails, and the crown of thorns. These instruments of the passion, Borsuk suggests, quote, refer to the earthly Jerusalem, where their relics were revealed in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Moreover, she adds, the lance, mentioned at the beginning of the text, had a special relevance to the taking of Jerusalem, because, as it was reported, the head of the Holy Lance was found at the siege of Antioch. This is the lance which pierces the side of Christ crucified. And the head of this lance was found, allegedly, at the siege of Antioch, after St. Andrew appeared in a vision to give directions for its discovery, an event which mustered the crusaders' morale in their final drive to Jerusalem. This same lance, with a drop of blood issuing from the head, is the first of the marbles to pass in front of Chrétien's Percival in the hall of the Fisher King. It appears at the same point in Wolfram's Mountain, also as a bleeding lance. And we later hear from him that it is the cause of the wounding of the Fisher King. Also known as the Spear of Longinus, this was the lance which pierced the side of Christ as he hung on the cross. The blood which flowed from his side was, in other royal texts, said to have been collected by St. Joseph of Arimathea in the grail itself, where it's identified as the cup of the Last Supper. From these facts, we may gather that the Fisher King in the grail stories was readily equated with Christ. Would you return in a moment? Borsa, the writer about these mosaics, warns the reader that her reading of the Palermo mosaics may be controversial, but in fact, she's unlikely to be wrong. For her views are borne out by the Otranto mosaic made at the same time. But basically, the message of the Otranto mosaic is the same as the message of the Palermo mosaic. I mean, the idea of a return to paradise. As the sacred historic mission of Normans. Okay, so this return to the Otranto mosaic now, made in 1165, which tells a similar story of the divine mission of Normans to enable mankind's return to paradise by a return to Jerusalem. Occupying the entire pavement of the Norman Cathedral of Otranto, the mosaic depicts a huge tree covered in foliage, in which we see depicted various beasts and topics from biblical history, such as the expulsion of Adam and Eve from paradise, Cain and Abel, the Tower of Babel and Noah's Ark. The trunk of the tree stretches up the nave from the door to the altar, at which point we can see that this is the tree of life and good and evil. For here we see Adam and Eve being cast out. However, all is not lost. The mosaic seems For as Adam raises his arm in exit, the gesture is matched by the raised arm of King Arthur. Mounted for action, and seeing you there to greet the last suffering, Rex Arturus. Nearby, out of your picture, is King Alexander, labeled Alexander Rex. As Norris J. Lacey has said of King Arthur's presence here, quote, the proximity to Alexander may indicate a political agenda, for the Norman kings of southern Italy claimed Alexander and Arthur as ancestral figures. However, there's a further point to be made here. Both are associated with the search for paradise. Alexander famously attempted to fly to the heavenly paradise, as shown here in this mosaic, in a throne supported by two griffins. And Arthur famously sponsored the search for the Grail, a figure of paradise and excellence. Below this group, the theme of the recovery of paradise is further depicted in the figure of the good thief, to whom Christ turned as he hung from the cross and said, today you shall be with me in paradise. In the mosaic we have, he waits at the closed gate. You can just see the closed gate of paradise in your picture. He waits there, the good thief, to be the first among the redeemed souls to enter the kingdom of heaven. However, the great biblical theme of mankind's recovery of paradise does not stop with the crucifixion of the good thief. Hanging among the branches in three rows of four are 12 medallions depicting the labours of the monks with their accompanying signs of the zodiac. In part, the labours are there to show the efforts of ordinary people, sowing and ploughing in the agricultural year, but taking their place, it should be stressed, within the great scheme of redemption, which is brought to a conclusion in the great year via the zodiac, when the heavenly kingdom appears at the end of time. For these 12 great hanging fruits, the zodiacal signs, are none other than the 12 manner of fruits, quote, which hang on the tree of life, which is planted in the midst of the New Jerusalem, as given in the book of Revelation, where it says, quote, in the midst of the street of Israel on the side of the river, was there the tree of life, bare 12 manner of fruits, and yielded their fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. Well, I'm picking up on that particular text and identifying those 12 fruits, one for every month, as the zodiac. Seems to give birth to a second book interpretation. So here I identify as the zodiac, the 12 fruit hang in Otranto's tree, which we can now recognize to be not only the tree of life which grew in paradise at the beginning of time, but the tree of life which grows in paradise at the end of time. Thus viewed, the mosaic of Otranto takes the overarching biblical story of paradise lost and found and shows the roles, the key roles, which the Normans have already been playing in this vast drama via their cultural heroes, such as Arthur and Alexander. But more than that, by placing the mosaic on the floor of a church in a seaport town, from which Norman crusaders were currently setting sail for the earthly Jerusalem, those who commissioned it were eager to show that the Norman forces were still vitally concerned with the recovery of paradise. For the earthly Jerusalem to which they were sailing prefigured the heavenly Jerusalem, the future paradise of state at the end of zodiacal time. Crusaders who knelt on the floor mosaic at Otranto were thus enabled to view their lives and their sacrifice as a vital part of sacred history, divinely instituted. Here was King Arthur, their great ancestor, who was second train the chivalric search for that paradise of heaven called the Grail. And here were they kneeling in response to that same call. But what was the meaning of the Grail? How did it fit into the Norman conception of the great cycles of time? The whole mosaic was made by the priest Pantaleone at the request of Archbishop Jonathan, as an inscription tells us, Here were those then who might sit with crusaders and point to the meaning of the mosaic in which the Grail is, in which the Grail is depicted, if Ian and Dyfed Beg are right. In their book, which I mentioned a moment ago, In Search of the Holy Grail, Traveller's Guide, they describe how at Otranto, a water-pouring angel in the silent Aquarius holds what they call the Grail, from which a second tree grows, and grows robustly. Well, what is the meaning of this second tree? Why is it growing in the sign of Aquarius? And how might the priests of Otranto have explained its relationship to the Arthurian quest for the Holy Grail? It's there in Aquarius. For answers, we need to turn to the Quest del San Graal, a further Norman Grail text written about 1220, which has a chapter called The Legend of the Tree of Life, in which this second tree takes centre stage. The story runs that when Eve was driven from paradise, she inadvertently took with her a sprig of the tree which grew in paradise, and realising what she'd done, then planted it in the wilderness outside, where it grew robustly by the will of God, as a speaking witness to future generations, for its legend was preserved along with these words from Eve herself. So wherever the secretary was mentioned, here was the words of Eve were preserved according to this text, the best of San Graal, and Eve's words are, "Be not dismayed if we are banished from our inheritance. It is not lost to us eternally. See here a sign of our return hereafter." The time of that return, it would seem, was indicated by the sign of Aquarius, here containing the grail-like vessel from which Eve's tree was shown to spring. In other words, the zodiac at Otranto, like the zodiac alluded to in Wolfram's Parzival, was meant to signify the great cycle of time, sacred, which would draw humanity back to paradise, aided by the Normans. It's time then finally to return to that key passage in Parzival and try to show that it too equates this future time of joy with the future age of Aquarius. So here's the quotation again. The wise Master Chaot found the tale. He read the truth about Mazadan beyond doubt. The account of the latter's whole lineage was faithfully recorded there. And on the female side, how Tichurel and his son, Finutel, bequeathed the Grail to Amfortas, the Fisher King, whose sister was Lady Sigoide, on whom Gareth begot a son to the Sarah's as well. Okay, let Amfortas, the Fisher King, stand for the age of Pisces, and the rest unfolds using a retrograde sequence of the zodiac, which we enter in Taurus with the Grail Lord Tichurel, about whom we are told only that his livery displayed a turtle dove. But this is enough to suggest the sign of Taurus, ruled by Venus, to whom the dove was sent. Okay. Tichurel handed it down to his son, Fumitel, the text continues, who, brave knight, was displaying his Grail. When he lost his life in a joust, Frimutel loved his wife so dearly that no wife was ever loved more by husband. He was also Lord of the Grail. Well, as a brave knight who dies fighting, Frimutel readily symbolizes the adjacent sign to Taurus in the retrograde sequence, Aries, ruled by the warrior god Mars. The reference to husband and wife is legitimately pulled from Libra opposite, the sign of the autumnal equinox, in which the equal balance of darkness and light, like that of the vernal equinox in which Aries begins, was deemed to symbolize the perfect balance of female and male, wife and husband. The zodiacal route from Taurus to Aries takes us next to Pisces, where Amfortas, the Fisher King, presides, and then on into the Sinai Aquarius, where Percival will become the new Grail King and restore paradise, where the wasteland will be done with and joy return. The same is told in Otranto in the Sinai Aquarius, where the words of the king are spoken by the priest as he shows the crusader the tree springing from the Grail. Be not dismayed. If we are banished from our inheritance, it is not impossible to return. See here, in Aquarius, the sign of our return. Medieval teachings concerning the future age of Aquarius were undoubtedly based, as they are in the modern period, on the biblical passage concerning the Last Supper, in which Christ directs his disciples to look for a man bearing a pitcher of water, that they might find the upper room, in which he would say to them, picking up the cup of the Last Supper, I will drink no more of the fruit of the vine, until that day I drink it new in the kingdom. It's universally understood that simply Christ in his first coming was the fish, and the zodiacal reading of Christ's mission therefore lays stress upon the retrograde movement of the zodiac in time, from the 12th sign Pisces, the fish, to the 11th sign Aquarius, the man bearing a pitcher of water, in which Christ will restore paradise and conditions. And no doubt our illumined priests of Otranto could reveal the whole zodiacal scheme of biblical history should their visiting crusaders require it of them. But their ships will grow restless in the harbour, and you grow restless in your seats to hear more about them when is done. But let us remember that the zodiac found at the Norman Cathedral in Otranto and in Wolfram's story of the Grail jointly testify to the survival into the Middle Ages of an esoteric Christian teaching that paradise will be renewed in the Age of Aquarius, and that these two texts, the Romance and the Aetheric, have served as well in opening up a little explorer's chapter of Western esotericism as it played out in the Crusader culture of southern Germany, southern Italy, and the Kingdom of Sicily. Thank you, Chris.
Paul. Many times the mention of the wounding of the Fisher King, and it's still unclear to me what was the origin of the Fisher King himself and that wound that is always spoken about.
He goes to the castle and finds that it was the Fisher King actually who owns the castle. So the first illusion, the first reference.
Does it come from a particular, where is that particular place?
And Wolfram mentioned that takes over that story completely. Yes.
Who talked about Nostradamus, who knew. been a, for a long time, I've often suspected that the word Detroit itself comes from the name of that town, and that that might have been the source of the origin of the prophecy itself. Well, I'm going to say the prophecy is which also ties into the fact that the major arcana is all about working to live with the tree of life and how it operates. And when you get into Kabbalism, especially in the Lurian Kabbalism, where he was emphasizing that man's purpose for being even created was to attend to the spirit of the tree of life and to the rectification of the supernal object, which is the divine man. There's also a legend in the Zohar that parallels the story of Eve bringing the tree out. But in this, it deals with Adam, and that God in the garden before the fall had given Adam a book called the Book of the Generation of Mankind, which I have often said it's mentioned prevalently in the Zohar. And I have often been suspicious of it having the source of the origins of the Chinese card because it is alleged to be a book of pictures.
The main drift of what Gary is saying there is that the arches from the earth by Remy continue to be a lineage through which many esoteric teachings flow, particularly leading to the construction of the first tarot deck in around 1440, that was the Visconti deck. And that deck itself enjoins upon mankind a return to paradise.
Absolutely right. It's all the major arcana is all about what they call rectification of the divine man.
Yeah. And so this really does,
which would be
extra assurance to this idea.
The second tree. Yeah. So like it was the first tree, you were shut out from that, but then it's to bring back the second tree. The second tree is man. But when I talk about man, I'm talking about male and male.
This double tree also features in the Medici family. Let me just mention, Eric Lee was mentioned. Let me link that to what's been said about the golden section. There's a researcher called Joan Helm, Dr. Joan Helm, Queensland University, in around 2000-2001, was undertaking a PhD, which is looking through manuscripts of the Arthurian legends. She's reading the manuscript through, but suddenly she comes across a huge illuminated image for no good reason. Anyway, she then counts the line numbers of the whole text and counts the number of lines to that random initial, and it's exactly on the golden section. So it seems that there is this reference to the Greek mysteries coming through into Chrétien's into his grasp of what's important. Yes, and also scholars are quite confused and bewildered by there's a wedding in America. Chrétien describes the cloak, isn't it? Just
he also mentions the cloak.
And the embroidery on
the garment.
It's the garment. There's the photography, isn't it, that's embroidered there. The pursuit of astronomy, the geometry, the higher learning.
And Mercantile mysticism, which is chariot mysticism, is also known as throne mysticism. But the chariot of God and the throne of God.
Right, so what does that take? Is there any other questions and queries in addition to
you were in Spain, you talked about it here as well, having
the Spanish traditions I talked about in Spain. Yes.
Right.
And they were all true. Yeah, now these are all true. These are true.
That are quite right. Yes, I find it fascinating to have your information working very well. So
considered an Asian dish. Other people say, no, it's a deer to knock out the owl, a gradle, a graduated entry into the mysteries. There are others anyway, but we don't really know what great means. The first use of the word is a critical dish, first of all. And it doesn't say the grail, it says, oh, Megan's grail. She was carrying a grail, you know. Anyway, and then after that, it's always the grail. It is hugely important.
Yes, Kip. In my class, invariably, I don't know if it's easy to an older materialism, but the literal.
Glastonbury was always